Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. Ahead on the show today, we'll head to Paris to see what covering the presidential election process is like for a political cartoonist. And we'll meet the people behind Photo London to find out what a photography fair can do for a city's art scene. But before all of that, I'll be joined in the studio by the film critic Jason Solomons and editor-at-large of the art newspaper Jane Morris, who will be telling me what's on the silver screen this week and why we all need to jump on a plane to Venice this month. All that ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Jason Solomons, Jane Morris, welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having us.
Both.
Thank
you. Lovely to see you, as always. Let's begin with a trip to the cinema with you, Jason. Let's start with a new documentary called Citizen Jane, Battle for the City, which tells the story of Jane Jacobs, the activist and author of the death and life of great American cities who fought to preserve city life in the face of destructive development projects. Shall we start, Jason, with a clip? Let's do that as a scene setter. Let's take a listen.
Jane Jacobs has written a book that advances with the power of a bulldozer against modern city planning and rebuilding.
She is the antennae that's picking up something here that no one else is seeing.
She believed the city is not about buildings, the city is about people.
She was questioning orthodoxy at a time when women were not welcomed in those environments.
She was a housewife. That's how they treated her.
Unorthodox, sort of notorious, Jason. Tell us why this story, well, does it work? And if it does, why? What's the sort of the essence of the Jane Jacobs tale?
I mean, Citizen Jane, Battle for the City, which sounds like sort of the third installment in a Tolkien or something. It is a quintessential battle of souls here. I didn't know this story at all. It's about Citizen Jane, Jane Jacobs, who had kind of these big glasses and a kind of pudding bowl haircut. And she was kind of a square activist, in a little bit of a hippie, I suppose, in New York. And this big kind of capitalist, Robert Moses, who was a town planner par excellence in the Le Corbusier manner, but then kind of went a bit sort of power hungry and started driving motorways through the city and kind of envisaged a city of the future that would have ended up looking a bit like The Fifth Element or something, where highways were everywhere. So it became a battle about this kind of little kind of vegan against this kind of sort of big industry. It's a brilliant battle for the soul, which works as drama. So the documentary is kind of best practice, and the documentary is really well set out. You had those who kind of really are in favour of what Jane Jacobs activism and anti-NIMBYism was. It was kind of like, I live in Greenwich Village and I'm going to save this place. And then he was kind of, no, we need some express highways to get the motor car going through New York. So you've got this fascinating battle. In a way, this is a documentary. In a way, you expect it to be like some Aaron Brockovich drama. I'm sure one day Scarlett Johansson will be kind of playing Jane Jacobs up against the kind of maybe Robert De Niro as Bob Moses. And you can see that I'm casting it already. I want some money in this film. So actually, when Jane Jacobs' writings are voiced over in the film, they're done by Marisa Tomei, actually, and Vincent D'Onofrio gets to do the voice of
also
Bob
good
Moses.
Very,
not
that
bad
would be
as
watchable,
is, you know,
that would
exactly
work.
But a little bit cheaper on documentary scale. But you see why there's this kind of class action kind of battle going on. And I suppose it's very now, you know, it's how we can sort of stand up to big business or big government in a way. So it's a very sort of Trump, I mean, we say this about every film now, it's a very Trump America film. Oh, it's very, very relevant now. Of course, it was made probably way before anyone had envisaged what was going to happen. But it is about activism, and it is about sort of standing up for how you believe cities should be. And I think that's what's so fascinating about it, whatever the politics of it. Cities are growing, and that's what the doc's quite good at. It's kind of sort of saying that if we continue building cities in the way that Robert Moses would have wanted, and we are creating the slums of the future. In fact, they use the example of modern China being very much on that model, that you're building segregated communities. Jane Jacobs was very much for kind of mixes and diversity on the street, but not just of colours, but of businesses and of wealth brackets and of different ages all mingling together, and that's what makes cities.
An enlightened viewpoint, one might say. Now, regular listeners to one of our sister programmes, the Monocle Weekly, may have heard Monocle's editor Andrew Tucker and myself talking to the people behind this film. Tell us a bit more about them, Jason. And, you know, obviously, essentially from what you say, that they steward this project very well. I mean, you can see how it would appeal to a director. It is a sort of almost a good versus evil. It's quite a traditional narrative almost. But tell us a bit about that.
And there's a lot of stuff around. There's a lot of archive. There's a lot of kind of newsreel. There's a lot of kind of newspaper footage. There's a lot of kind of, it's a really good archival movie. You kind of delve back into this town. I mean, really, essentially, we're talking about a series of town planning meetings, and they actually make it sort of sing on the screen, which is kind of some sort of alchemical brilliance.
Sexy town planning.
Sexy town planning. You know, you do it. But I mean, you know, you've got Save Washington Square movements. Interesting enough, she didn't save the Bronx. The Cross Bronx Expressway was a rather famous project. We kind of divided families and swayed through that northern section of Manhattan. And in fact, gave, oddly enough, the documentary doesn't mention this, but it did give birth to hip hop. So out of the rubble cometh something.
There can be beauty.
There can be beauty. It did. And I think Baz Luhrmann's series, The Get Down, which is currently on Netflix, starts with the Crosstown Expressway, which is where I first heard it. And that, out of that comes graffiti and hip-hop and all that culture, because it kind of segments communities. So it's interesting. I think the film is very much on the human spirit side, in that it kind of says, well, in the end, we can defeat all of these things, but everyone who's kind of been through a bad council estate or seen them being erected and ripped down in their lifetime, be it in London or in Seoul or anywhere, will see that those projects have sort of failed in a way, and that street life will out. And that's what this film's very much, and Jane Jacobs' original book, are very much about. And it's sort of on the side of hope, which is why I can see it being a big Hollywood movie one day.
And Jane, it's interesting. I guess you're, well, it's a namesake of yours, of course. I don't know whether that alone would draw you to the silver screen, but yeah, it's interesting. Even in the art world, often we talk about this thing about cities that are being so developed, overdeveloped, repurposed, that we price out or plan out creatives, that space for interesting things to happen. I mean, this is a narrative that's very relevant. You know, look around us in London, isn't it? It's something that people in the art world and the broader community talk about all the time.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And actually, when I was listening to you, I was thinking about, you know, the kind of rows that are going on around the Robin Hood Gardens estate out in the East End. Ooh. I mean, a famous building listed. The plans now, I think, are to try to knock it down, but the community are hanging in there as much as they can. I think similar things are happening on the Aylesbury estate, where that estate was something that people felt very strongly was a mistake and should be knocked down. But actually, people now want to stay there because they don't want to let happen what happened at Elephant and Castle, where everybody has been basically socially cleansed to the margins of London. So I think even with our brutalist estates, it's an ongoing narrative. I really want to see this. It sounds great.
Yeah, and there's a British film actually, it's sort of out at the same time, called A Moving Image, which is about gentrification in Brixton, made by an artist from Brixton going back there and kind of sort of being part of the problem and sort of saying, well, now I'm an artist with my coffee and my quinoa. I'm part of the problem here, that the Brixton riots. I'm kind of shoving them out because I want to live in a loft and make a documentary.
Yeah, I live in Shoreditch, and I moved to Shoreditch in the mid-90s, and I was part of the problem. I mean, Shoreditch is now, the last studios are being knocked down now. I think Long Street's going, Creamer Street's going, and I think those are the two last studio blocks in Shoreditch.
And indeed, Citizen Jane, she makes much sort of saying, well, if we had had this lower Manhattan expressway that Bob Moses wanted, we wouldn't have had Soho, and we wouldn't have had the Village. And I said, well, that's great in the 80s and 90s, yes, Soho's gone. Right now, basically, we wouldn't have had, what, another branch of J. Crew. Really? What did she save us from? America's shopping mall. So it's very interesting how quickly that gentrification and kind of the good thing that she preserved there, I don't know what it is now. Gentrification has taken over and driven a consumerist highway through it.
It was under pressure then, and it's under a different kind of pressure, but still under pressure nevertheless now. You can judge for yourselves. Citizen Jane, Battle for the City is out now in the US and selected cinemas in the UK. Let's move on to something completely different. Unlocked. This big blockbuster is the latest from a veteran British director, Michael Apted, the man behind a long list of film and TV series, including the 1999 James Bond iteration, The World Is Not Enough. Perhaps not one of anyone's favourites, but we'll maybe come back to that. We can imagine what this might be like, Jason. Is it a kind of smash-bang wallop, what subprime World Is Not Enough? Is it more like his 7-Up films, The Amazing Old World in Action, one of my favourite TV programmes ever that he made when he must have been about 15 years old.
Well, and 22, and 29.
Where does it fit in?
Well, it's not like 7-Up, sadly. Okay. Which I suppose Richard Linklater's Boyhood was this kind of 7-Up's kind of filmic model. And Richard Linklater's made great sort of doffing of the cap to Michael Apted. But Michael Apted is also a sort of great blockbuster. I mean, he made The World Is Not Enough, which is kind of a mad Bond movie. And here, actually, this is The World Is Not Enough, but with a woman inside. This is Jane Bond, if you like, going on from Citizen Jane. Starring Noomi Rapace as a kind of, it's called Unlocked because she's a sort of sleeping CIA agent who is drawn back in by Michael Douglas, who in this film seems to live on Highbury Fields, which is, as someone who lives quite near there, I've never seen him there. There's lots of London locations. You're going, I sort of recognise that rooftop. And so, I quite like this. I mean, it is absolutely nonsense. I mean, to the point where the audience was laughing in all the wrong places. But I think that was part of the enjoyment. She's very good, Noomi Rapace. You remember she was the girl with a dragon tattoo. And now she's the girl with a license to kill. I mean, she really kind of springs to life. She's very good at this action stuff. And they tried to find a lot of female action heroines. I mean, not just in the sort of Scarlett Johansson, Black Widow-ish, Ghost in the Shells, or Gal Gadot now as Wonder Woman, but as a kind of normal person who you can sort of imagine kind of going about her everyday business, but also being able to kill people with a stare. And Noomi Rapace is excellent at it. And so she's awoken by some... My only problem with it is that it has got the kind of, who can we make the big baddies? Oh, jihadis. I'm like, come on, there are other baddies in the world, but it's all about this jihadis in the sleeper cells down in Newham, and she's kind of involved in those, and then it kind of, there's a Mujahideen thing and a kind of imam, and they have to kind of go translating and no one understands it, and then John Malkovich is in Langley in Virginia on a screen going, speaking to Toni Collette, who's back in MI5 doing, I think, an audition for the Annie Lennox story, because if that ever happens, she'd be perfect.
She's a shoo-in. Now, you've reeled off a few names there. You've got Noomi, Orlando Bloom, does he
Orlando,
pop up as well?
I forgot Orlando
Michael
Bloom.
Douglas, Toni Collette, John Malkovich, big names. I'm always interested in this question. 5 years from now, maybe 10 years, Jason, will they say, apart from my bank balance, yeah, I'm glad I did that, or may it be to the contrary?
As they sort of, you know, flick on the sort of widescreen TV in their man cave extension, which this film played for, they'll probably think, oh, I'm glad I did that movie. Look, Orlando Bloom's in it, again, doing something new. He's a kind of ex-Marine, speaking like that. And there's a bit where Noomi Rapace kind of gets some tape and puts it over his mouth. The audience cheers. I mean, he's just kind of ridiculous. But I must say I quite enjoyed it, and it's definitely unlocked a franchise. I think we'll see more of her.
Well, I was going to ask you about this.
Has he created
a monster, potentially?
I think it could be quite a good one. I mean, I think people want to say, I don't think Michael Apted will be doing many more of these, because he's kind of getting old, you know, and he's got some more 7-Ups to kind of do, I'm sure. But I think he's set a good template here for kind of, it's kind of sub-Bourne in a way, but she's very Jason Bourne. There's lots of people wearing baseball caps, walking around and kind of surveillance stuff. And I quite like that stuff. Either Jason Bourne's are ridiculous. We've had five of them so far, and they even changed Bourne and no one noticed, and they come back and it's Matt Davis. So, you know, it's all possible. So Noomi Rapace and others can all look forward to playing Alice Racine, you see, which in French means root, you see. So I think we're kind of...
It's clever, isn't it?
Out of this will grow a mighty tree.
Jane, what about this? Jane Bond, another sort of almost near namesake.
What's with the Jane?
Would this coax you to the cinema? It sounds like rather good fun, doesn't it?
It sounds good fun to me, actually. I really loved the first Jason Bourne, and I think this sounds kind of comedic, and you're tempting me with Orlando Bloom and the Mockney.
Unlocked is out in cinemas today, if you want to follow Jason's urging and Jane's instincts to go and see it. Jason, thanks for talking us through this week's films. We'll be hearing more from Jane shortly on the Venice Biennale, but first we head to Paris, where election fever is in full swing, just days away from the vote that will declare either Le Pen or Macron the new president. That means long days and nights for people working for the French press, whether you're a journalist or a political cartoonist. Like Willem, originally from the Netherlands. Willem's been drawing for decades and is a notorious cartoonist for French publications. Our reporter Jesse Roger met him in the heart of Saint-Germain in Paris to talk about drawing the two French presidential candidates and how life changed after the murder of his colleagues in the attacks on Charlie Hebdo's offices back in 2015.
It's a job I love. Drawing to assassinate people.
Now, say, take someone like Macron, a popular candidate here, especially with younger people. How do you first begin drawing him? Do you look at images of him, photographs, television broadcasts? How do you begin constructing a drawing?
In the beginning it was difficult because he looked so normal. Nothing strange about him. Hairdo, nose. He was too normal, and a drawing of him, nobody would recognize it. So you must exaggerate some things always in a caricature. So there's a blue eye, and it's his boyish face, and enthusiastic. Well, he appeals to a lot of people, and people are running away from other parties to him, because he can be anything, left, right, center. So it's very, very strange that he is so popular, I think. He is smooth. He looks like he comes always straight from the shower. And it is not nice to draw. And Le Pen, of course, I have drawn her 1,000 times. But I love in drawing people is that they got wrinkles that makes their face readable. And I follow it from day to day, how they are changing.
And what do you hope people get from your work?
Fun. And 2 years ago, when my colleagues were murdered, I was extremely angry and I wanted to strike back with my drawings, of course. And that was not really fun, but I think it was effective.
So when the attack occurred and in 2015, you were on the train and your colleagues were in a conference, a meeting, the daily editorial meeting. How has that moment changed your work and the work and your art as a whole?
Not really changed, but I feel that I must be more direct and effective and more black and white and more direct.
Is there a limit for you when you draw, a limit of subject? Is there ever a point at which you stop yourself drawing a subject that you will never touch? Or?
No, not really. I don't draw about economy because I don't understand it, but I've always been interested in cartoons and expressing things with the pen. I would not paint landscapes or something. That doesn't interest me. I want to communicate in newspapers, and that's my job.
Do you think that being a cartoonist in France is different to being a cartoonist in a political cartoonist in other countries?
I think so. France has a great tradition in cartooning, and in quite hard cartoons since 1900. You had La Chateaubert. They, if they see a cartoon, they know how you almost interpret it.
Say you were to draw France right now, and if it could be an animal, or a landscape, or a flag, or I don't know what, how would you draw France right now at this very moment?
Well, it would be quite schizophrenic drawing, because France is divided. The normal political parties are a bit out of touch, and they are from one extreme to another now. So that would be a strange portrait.
That was political cartoonist Willem speaking to our Jesse Roger in Paris. France votes to decide the outcome of this year's elections on the 7th of May. This is the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. I'm here in Studio One with film critic Jason Solomons and editor-at-large of the art newspaper Jane Morris, who I turn to now to ask about the Venice Biennale. Jane, this is the biggest event in the art calendar. The art world, it's kind of buzzing, I guess, this month. Well, let's zero in. What do you, if anything, and I presume that you do, look forward to in particular about this year's iteration?
I should say that this year is actually a Venice Documenta Munster year, which only happens every 10 years. So not only do we have the Venice Biennale, we have Documenta, which is in Athens and Kassel in Germany for the first time. It's always in Kassel, but it's in Athens as well. And there's the Munster Sculpture Project. So there is too much art for anyone to take in one go. Turning straight on to Venice. Venice is, I have to say, just kind of too much, really. We all look forward to it. It is the big art world jamboree. Almost everyone who's anybody will get there for the first week if they can. And if they can't, they'll be there a few weeks later. And everybody will spend the entire season running into each other, asking each other what they thought, saying which shows they thought were the worst, which were the sort of standout, who are the new stars and so on. But it is ridiculously vast. The director's exhibition is in two huge venues. There's 120 artists in those. There's almost 90 national pavilions, and some of those are almost substantial exhibitions in their own right. There are another about 50 exhibitions, including some really major ones. There is a major Philip Guston show at the Academia. There is a major show of Mark Toby, who is an American abstract painter, not well known like Jackson Pollock, but certainly on the rise in terms of his reputation. I mean, he's dead now, but certainly he's on the rise. And there's a major show of his work at the Peggy Guggenheim collection. There is an enormous Damien Hirst exhibition in two venues, the Punta della Dogana and the Palazzo Grassi. So the big challenge for everybody is going to be deciding what they're going to go and see.
And they have got their work cut out. Some of those numbers are quite arresting. We'll talk Damien Hirst in a minute. What about then the development then of the whole of the Venice Biennale? I mean, is it interesting? Is it important to try and chart how it's evolved, what its objectives are? You know, I wonder, they always have these themes, don't they? And we've got Viva Arte Viva is a sort of theme this year. How do you possibly bring a coherent theme to something that is so vast?
Well, that's the director's exhibition that's got the main title, Viva Arte Viva. I think that in one sense, it's always going to be impossible. So as a result, every Biennale has some pretty generic sort of titles. I think the last one was All the World's Futures. Having said that, the more of them you see, the more you can see decidedly different concerns in them. So I would say the one, six years back, which was curated by Massimiliano Gioni, who's an Italian, but he's based in New York at the New Museum. His show was really about outsiders. So it was about artists who might actually also be therapists. It might be artists who were in mental institutions or could have been. It was about artists who are just outside the mainstream. That was followed by Okwienwuzor in 2015. And his was really a big critique of capitalism, a theme we're also going to see in Documenta, I think. This year. Christine Massel, she's chief curator at the Pompidou, has been brought in to do Viva Arte Viva, which I think is sort of life, art, life or art lives, however you choose to say it. Basically, she is, I think, turning away from this kind of very political statement kind of exhibition. And this is going to be an exhibition that's much more about art and the life of artists. So my understanding is that the show will start in the artist's studio. It's even going to start with artists doing nothing, because she's very keen on the idea that artists should have time to do
Surely no artists do nothing, do they?
Well, they're supposed to get their ideas from somewhere. So I think the idea is more sort of, you know, meditation and reflection rather actually just, you know, having a kip. It's going to start in the artist's studio and it's going to end somewhere out in the universe. She's been talking about art with a spiritual dimension, which is a phrase we haven't heard for a good 30 or 40 years. So I think this is going to be a very different kind of show.
Is it a market as well, like Cannes for film? Do you go and buy stuff to go? People kind of program their galleries or say, well, I'm going to have that when it tours and we definitely want that.
This is fascinating because at one time, when the Biennale was actually set up, which is in the late 1890s, there was a sales office. There was a sales office, I think, until the 50s. And one of the stated aims of it was to sell. They actually were focusing on selling Italian art, really. But the idea was to sell art. Since then, there has been this sort of holding two ideas at the same time. Ostensibly, it is not a selling exhibition, neither the director's exhibition, nor the pavilions, nor any of the exhibitions. In reality, every artist gallerist is lined up three deep. They will all be having dinners and they've all been sending JPEGs to their favourite collectors. The collectors will be invited to events to meet the artists and so on and so forth. And it's pretty obvious that by the time we get to Art Basel, which is in the second week of June, which is an official art fair, everyone will be sitting there, the big collectors will all be sitting there discussing what they bought out of Venice. And for example, the Zeitz Moca, which is a big new museum that's opening in South Africa, it's owned by Jochen Zeitz, who is the, he made all his money with Puma shoes and clothes. His curators pretty much said that they are going to be looking in Venice to look for standout African contributions with a view to buying them.
So the bloke in the white trainers, go to him.
Exactly.
Now, one of the biggest draws, you already mentioned it, Jane, in Venice will be the show happening alongside the Biennale, Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable, the title of Damien Hirst's first major solo exhibition in Italy since 2004, located in the Palazzo Grassi and the Punta della Dogana until early December. Quite a name, quite a show, Jane?
It's an enormous show. It's actually the first set of new work he's made since 2008, Beautiful Inside My Head, which you may remember when he basically took all his new work, bypassed his dealers, consigned the lot directly to auction. And I think it was the night that Lehman Brothers collapsed that the auction took place. And I think the total sales were about £200 million, I think, at the time. Well, this is a huge show and it really is new work. There are some of Damien Hirst's favourite themes in there. So there are cabinets, you know, he made the famous pill cabinets. There are skulls in vitrines, which obviously reference his liking for skulls and also famous animals in formaldehyde vitrines. But generally, there's some completely new things. There are these characters that are straight out of, I don't know, Tomb Raider meets Game of Thrones meets some kind of Hollywood fantasy epic. And in fact, I think if this show reminds me of anything, it is a Hollywood epic. It's got this made-up tale, which is that 2,000 years ago, a collector has amassed all his treasures onto a ship. The ship has sunk, sort of under its own hubris, if you like, somewhere off the African coast. They have actually put a lot of the works on the seafloor and then got divers to retrieve them. They're going to make a documentary about it, which they're hoping to show at the Venice Film Festival. It's been shot by a National Geographic photographer. So there's this whole tale of sunken treasures, which Damien Hirst has found 2,000 years later and has retrieved and has now turned into a massive museum exhibition in two venues. And it is a Hollywood fantasy exhibition.
Well, Jason, I must ask you then. It's cinematic in its scope and its ambition.
Like a great idea. I mean, it's a very good idea. If you're, I suppose, a Cecil B. DeMille of the art world, which Damien Hirst seems to me, then you can do this stuff. You know what I mean? You're ready for your close-up, really, aren't you? You can say, well, I'm going to mount this production. And it sounds, I mean, I'd like to see a movie about such things. And I have read that the stuff is kitschy, almost in a way that a Hollywood set might be. Like, it's not kind of... it's meant to last for ages, although it has lasted for 2,000 years, but it's kind of made in sort of a, almost like set decorating style.
Well, it's interesting. It's actually made of the most exquisite materials, so it will last for a very, very long time. But it does look really kitschy.
Right.
So there is, if you've ever seen Jeff Koons's puppy made out of flowers, there are these bears that are made out of bronze, but they've been painted to look as if they're covered in coral. So there are sort of coral-covered bears with warrior goddesses, you know, 22-inch waists, bullet-hard boobs, in fantasy poses, standing on top of the bears and with, you know, lions and all sorts of creations. And I mean, they will last hundreds, if not thousands of years if they're looked after, those works. But they look pretty kitsch. And they are a big nod to Jeff Koons. There's lots of Artwell jokes in here. I mean, there's nods to Jeff Koons, there's nods to Paul McCarthy, Disney characters, encrustulated, coralised Disney characters. There's nods to Maurizio Cattelan, particularly the marble body bags. So there's kind of jokes and references to artists he likes, as well as references to, say, to these fantasy characters.
And is this the only place that's vast enough to hold it? I mean, is this an exhibition that can travel and we can see the same thing, or is it just bits of it we can see, like volume one, volume two?
Well, this is a really interesting question. I asked Science, who's Damien Hirst's management company. Now, nobody's actually giving away exact prices, but I reckon it probably cost £10 million, at least €10 million to install that exhibition. Hirst himself has said it cost more than £50 million for him to actually make the works. That's a huge amount of money, though, for an art exhibition. Yeah. So he said that this is what it's cost him to make. I think that it should travel. I think it would be great if it travelled. I think it should go to Los Angeles, and I think I'd love to see it in London. I think the question is there a collector like Francois Pinault, who has backed the installation in Venice? Is there a collector out there or a museum able and willing to pay for that? So at the moment they're saying, no, it's only going to be Venice, and that Hirst will do a commercial selling exhibition. I should add, all these works are for sale. And there is for sale in editions of three. So I think there are roughly 450 works priced somewhere between $500,000 and $5 million available. It is all for sale. But whether it'll go to another big museum, I don't know. I kind of think it would be good if it did. The art world is absolutely a buzz. I mean, if anything, I think they might be talking about this more than the rest of the whole Venice
exhibition. Which one can imagine it? If one man's happy about that, it might be our friend Damien Hirst, possibly.
Yeah.
Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable is on at the Palazzo Grassi in Punta della Dona until the 3rd of December. The Venice Biennale begins on the 13th of May. So check it out. Thanks for your art review today. While we're on the subject of art, there's another big event happening a little closer to Midori House this month. The third edition of Photo London kicks off in just a couple of weeks' time at Somerset House. The fair brings together plenty of big names, including Jane Morris, from the world of art and photography to examine its past, present and future. Photo London was masterminded by Fariba Farshad and Michael Benson, co-founders of the arts and education company Candlestar. They chatted to Monocle's own Holly Fisher earlier about this year's event and what the fair's done for London's photography scene.
Given the fact that London is the most, we think, important cultural city in the world, not having a photography fair was astonishing, and we needed to do something about it.
Yeah, and we thought it was the right moment, because what we saw through the various projects that we run at Candlestar was that there was enormous enthusiasm for photography, not only by collectors, but by sort of people between 18 and 35 for whom it was becoming the cultural activity of choice, which was great. So there's a lot of enthusiasm, and actually that enthusiasm translates. We've seen sort of 50 or 60 different cultural events, photography-related events, growing up during the course of the fair each year. So we were clearly tapping into something. We were actually at the right moment to be doing so.
So you found that there was a lot of need for this from the photography industry in London as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was a, I think with the, what they knew and the, which we didn't was how hard it was going to be. It was a bit of a hospital past. I mean, we were sort of naively went into it thinking it's going to be, well, and it actually was great. It is great, but it's a lot of hard work. And I think everyone recognised that to do it well was going to be tough. To do it would be quite easy, but to do it well. And we wanted to position Photo London as the best photography fair on the planet. So that was kind of a bit of a big aim. We were used to that sort of ambition. And if that we have that sort of ambition for the fair, then we had to kind of deliver on it. And that was the difficult part.
If you don't aim high, then you're never going to.
Exactly.
And so what do you hope something like this will do for London's photography scene?
I think it'll energise it. It'll energise it in a number of ways. I think that, as I said, the younger photographers, the younger collectors are beginning to understand the importance of collecting photography. And I think that photography is becoming one of the things that people start collecting when they begin to think about what form of art should we buy. What we're hoping is both that there'll be an enormous explosion of collector interest, everyone from sort of 18 to 85 and beyond will buy photographs. And actually that more and more people in London will become seen to be the place where you have to actually come if you want to understand where photography is going next, what the new developments in photography are. It has to be London.
The interest in photography has grown massively, especially now as everyone thinks they're a photographer.
Yeah.
Do you see the market corresponding to that?
I think the market is growing. The only little bit of dissent we had when we started is that some of the photography dealers themselves in London said, look, there's no market for photography here. It just won't work. And what was nice was the second year, one of them, and I won't tell you who it was, came to us and said, you guys pulled a rabbit out of a hat. I had no idea that there was a hat, and I certainly didn't think there was a rabbit inside it. I'm in for next year. So, I mean, that's the sort of thing we've been dealing with. I think the collecting scene will grow. And what's also been interesting to us is that a lot of collectors who can collect contemporary art are beginning to switch their attention to photography. And that's also, so you've got several things going on at the same time. You have a younger collector base growing. You have your established collectors who are still looking for new things, still looking to complete collections. And you have contemporary art collectors who are beginning to think, actually, photography is kind of interesting. This, we should really think more carefully about this.
And of course, institutions are very important in their role. The fact that Tate Modern employed a curator of photography 10 years ago, or V&A, always, you know, these sort of move historically will affect the whole trend and development of one genre, one part of art.
And where do you see the innovation in photography at the moment?
At the moment is just overwhelming in terms of how in different direction photography is moving, and technology is playing a great role in that. We will have a VR at Photo London, and that's by Matt Colin Shaw, is doing building the Fox Talbot 19th century first photography exhibition in Somerset House, and you just transport into this incredible, beautiful 19th century library, which I went and in his studio on Monday and experimented with the goggle and the computer, and you just walk free and you feel the heat, you touch the glass, and it's just mind-blowing. It's wonderful. So yes, all the new technology coming together for supporting this project.
And I always think that photography is maybe a genre of art that people don't necessarily know too much about the history of.
Yeah.
Your company is based within the arts and education. Do you feel that you have a responsibility to sort of teach people who the early photographers were, who were the pioneers?
Yeah, that's also part of that is to do with building a market as well. But I mean, we do, our backgrounds are both very much in education. We both were at the University of the Arts before we started Candlestar. Candlestar has always worked on education projects. One of the projects that we did most recently was to set up a college for Condé Nast. So education has been at the heart of what we do. And so we run, and it's very unusual this, but we run a series of talks and lectures throughout the year. So as soon as the fair is over, we begin planning the talks for the autumn so that there's probably a talk every month. And the interesting thing for us is that those talks sell out within 48 hours. So there's obviously a huge interest in. So when we in photography, and we spend a lot of time developing the audience and developing people's knowledge. And it's not just us. We bring in experts and other photographers and people who are experts on 19th century or conservation and curation, all those sorts of things. So we're trying to broaden people's understanding of what photography is and what it can be.
We had over 3,000 people attend a talks program last year. And we have 30 talks this year. So we are going to see, hopefully, even more people attending.
And let's talk about the talks, because there's so many brilliant names. Tell us about some of the highlights in the list.
Well, it's a bit unfair to the other ones who we don't mention, because there are 30 of them, and it'd be a bit boring to go through all 30. But I mean, people like Thomas Demand, Taryn Simon, who's our master of photography, will be talking. Nusha Tavakkolian is talking at the Portrait Gallery, who we have a special relationship with. We've done a couple of talks with them every year. William Klein is talking there too. And we have Bruce Davison, great photographer of the 50s, New York. So we have as you can hear, a huge range of different voices. And
I've got Anthony Gormley and Brian May too.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is what we said when we were doing this is we must reach out a little bit beyond North America and Europe. So we have Gaston Ulgarde coming from South America. We have Rena Effendi coming from Azerbaijan. So we begin to, we want to hear other voices, not just, I mean, when I say just, it's great to hear the great photographers of the photography strongholds, but it's also interesting to find new voices from elsewhere.
One of the ideas behind these talks is looking at where photography is going. Where do you think photography is going?
In a variety of directions all at once, I think, is where photography is going. I mean, clearly, technology is very important. One of the things that really interests us is the way that you think it's reached a dead end in a certain direction, and then you find a young photographer who's found a completely new way of doing something, which, you know, just turns everything on its head. So, for example, you have a number of young photographers who are using ancient techniques right from the beginnings of photography to do new work, and that's incredibly interesting. So there are photographers making work that has pins stuck in it. There are photographers making work that works in textiles and sculpture. Some of it crosses boundaries with paintings. I mean, what is really interesting for us is the way that photography is sort of generating a blurring of boundaries between disciplines, and that's just fascinating. So the answer, where is it going? I think it's going in a wonderful set of different directions in a myriad of different ways.
And we shouldn't forget that it is a very young medium and is just growing and learning and experimenting and, you know, finding its way to almost every other aspect of contemporary arts, which is fascinating to watch.
That was Fariba Farshad and Michael Benson, co-founders of Photo London, which kicks off on the 18th of May at Somerset House. You can find out more at photolondon.org. As always, to end the show, it's time for our global countdown, and we welcome Fernando Augusto Pacheco to the studio. Fernando, good to see you. Where are we going?
We are going to Norway, Tom, and we have a very special number one for you as well. But before that, we do our usual little countdown as well. Hope you enjoyed the number one, by the way, guys.
Let's start at number five, shall we?
Number five, again, as I've been talking, I think, since I started this slot on the Arts Review, it's Ed Sheeran with Shape of You. No surprise there. Number four, we have actually a local artist, but not many people know he's Norwegian. It's the DJ Kygo. And Kygo, basically, I wouldn't say he invented, but he became very popular with his tropical house beat, which basically, if you listen to the top 10, like nine songs will have the tropical house beat. But the number four, he's partnered with Selena Gomez with the great song It Ain't Me. I actually quite enjoy it, actually. Number three, Britain. Britain is there with Clean Bandit, is a band from Cambridge. And again, another partnership with a very cool singer, Zara Larsson. And the song is called Symphony, which is number one song in the UK.
There we go. So there's similarities, as we often find in these music charts. Is there anything, though, Fernando, not to jump straight to the number one spot at all, of course, but is there a uniquely Norwegian artist appearance trend on our list?
Well, I have to say, we're going to number one in a bit, but to be honest, Scandinavia, the main market, is always Sweden. I think Norway is always a bit left out. But I think things are starting to change, thanks actually to a TV series, which, actually, let me tell you number two very quickly. It's a track which has been already a success in all the Spanish-speaking countries. But now, thanks to Justin Bieber, now it's going to all the major markets. It's Despacito by Puerto Rican singer Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee. and Justin Bieber. Basically, Justin Bieber just say a few words. You know, if Justin Bieber say a few words,
it's gonna do big numbers.
Exactly, exactly. But guys, let's listen to number one. I want to hear your opinion before I talk a little bit about it. Let's hear it.
Only a brief listen. Jason, I'll jump straight in. What did you make of that little snippet?
Is that Norwegian hip-hop?
Exactly. You got it right. Again, with a Tropical House beat in the background, you know, just to
make it... What are they called, Norwegian hip-hop? Fjord hop.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. You heard it here first, people. You heard it here first. Jane, what about you? I could see you were looking at me. I couldn't tell whether it was approving or mildly concerned.
I sort of like kind of alternative indie rock, sweaty boys with guitars. So this isn't really me.
Possibly not squarely in your camp. Faye, tell us a bit more about it then. Jason was zeroed straight in on what it was. Tell us who it was.
Well, it's a good field hip hop indeed. Well, basically, they're a group of, as you say, hip hoppers from Norway. It's Temur and H-Kin. They're very young, they're 19, and one of them, H-Kin, he's just been rapping for the last year or so. It's quite recent in his career. The song is called Fi Fun, which I had to do a lot of research with my Norwegian skills. Fun is basically an expression in Norway which means hell, but I think for Norwegians it's considered kind of a swearing word, which is called like damn, oh fuck, you know, something like that. And in fact, I was reading an interview with one of them. They say it's a song about people that have too much negative vibes about them.
And it sounded quite kind of perky and upbeat.
I
have
to say,
for
it didn't
a
sound
negative
very negative to me.
Song,
it sounded extremely kind of, they really, really drank the Kool-Aid.
Very important to get the lyrics translated then.
Exactly,
case,
I felt more positive vibes actually. But there's an interesting story here, because this song became number one because it's a soundtrack of a very popular series at the moment in Norway, which is called Skam or Shame. It's currently in its fourth season. And the interesting thing here, because we don't see many Norwegian TV shows going abroad, but that's not the case. I mean, this series has been very popular in countries like Spain, Germany. And in fact, this track has been, I think it's trending in Spain at the moment. And people say, you know, I think it's the first time there's a song in Norwegian charting in Spain, thanks to this series, which I did some research. I mean, it looks like a story about like a group of teenage girls in a wealthy school in Oslo. But, you know, it's quite racy. You know, it talks about coming out of age, you know, and it looks quite interesting.
Indeed. It seems to change from the popular export of Scandi Noir to actually kind of get a bit of a youth energy going into that Scandinavian TV and exporting that and kind of bottling what the energy they had from Scandi Noir and kind of translating it into the rest of a younger culture. I think it's quite important.
I think so as well. Maybe we're a bit tired of Scandi Noir, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a bit of high school drama. I saw you've seen some shameful films. Have you seen Shame? Is that a new one on you, Jason?
I haven't, no, but I'm
going
to. It sounded very good.
Such good list of things to watch and things to,
busy now.
Things to listen to. What was your favourite, Fernando, of your top five? Well, is it going to be H-Kim and Temur with Fee Fun or something else?
I like it because it's in Norwegian. I love songs, you know, in Norwegian. But I like Despacito, I have to say.
Okay.
Not necessarily with Justin Bieber. I don't need Justin Bieber for...
So, Bieber, you lay out, leave off, and let Fernando get on with his rock outs. That's a good note on which to end the show, I think. Fernando, thanks for being with us. Thanks in particular also to my guests, to Jason Solomons and to Jane Morris. Thank you both. Enjoy your travels, Jane, to Venice. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Thanks to her too, and thanks of course to Fernando for his assistance. Join us at the same time again next week, but for now let's enjoy the rest of that number one track by H-Kim and Temur. This is Fee Fun. Take it away. For vi lever for å dø, til vi smelter bort som snø. Og de ser etter feil, men jeg flipper fingeren for jeg lager min vei. Når alle ber jeg stoppe opp, glem det å fokusere og jobb. For sjalusien den brenner, skjønt at mange bror må brenne, så alle ikke venner. Fy faen, fy fy faen, alle de er snakes og det helt normalt. Fy faen, fy fy faen, ingen er av ty til en mislykket dag. Fy faen, fy fy faen, alle gir meg hodepinne nå om dag. Fy faen, fy fy faen, dette er budskapet gjennom i sangen. Ai, 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 ai. Gjennom i sangen. Ai, 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 ai. Ai, 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 yeah. Dette er budskapet gjennom i sangen. Noe
moon falls, knocking me, yeah. Me about me, yeah. Snakker mye på mobilen, for kjær på den og de sløser bort tiden. Foran de må skje, vet det klisje. Dette ikke film, så sett deg ned og hør på når jeg gjør min ting. Fy faen, fy fy faen, mamma og gutta mine har begynt å høsle om dagen. Fy faen, fy fy faen, slangen kommer og går som en bumerang. Fy faen, fy fy faen, skal vise alle sammen for jeg sitter på en plan. Fy faen, fy fy faen, dette her budskapet gjennom en sang, yeah. Ai, 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 ai. Gjennom min sang, yeah. Dette budskapet gjennom min sang, yeah. Jeg skal vise mine enemies mens de på fest og drikker Hennessy. Har bare det i one, sing in front of me. Jobber 24-7, du vet at vi påler. Lager musikken som de spiller.